This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Shadows We Hide, written by Alan Eskins, read by Zach Villa. Dedication to Ben. Part 1. Chapter 1. I'm lying on the hood of my car, my back reclined against my windshield, knees bent, fingers laced together on my stomach, my breathing relaxed to ease the throb of pain. I'd like to say that having the tar beat out of me was the low point of my day, but that would be a lie. The beating that thug laid on me can't compare to the hurt I inflicted upon myself. The night around me is large and weightless, the kind of a night that demands honest contemplation, and I'm doing my level best to oblige. I feel like I'm in exile, a nomad of sorts, sharing my night with the stars and the trees and the occasional thistle seed that floats by in the summer breeze. I try to ponder the wrong turns that brought me here, but I can't seem to get past my pathetic excuses about why this shouldn't be my fault. I want to be like Adam and point my finger at the one who handed me the apple, or better yet, find a way to blame the serpent. But my conscience won't let me do that. I want to believe that I am a better man than I am, but I know that I am not. This one is on me, nobody else. I don't know when it happened, but at some point I got cocky. I stopped counting my faults and became charmed by the image I put forth for the rest of the world, a side of me that allows people to find their own kindness in my plight. You see, I've been taking care of my autistic brother Jeremy, going on 6 years now, and I have a girlfriend who I helped put through law school. People see those things and think, what a good guy that Joe Talbert is. They have become so blinded by the gleam of my armor that they haven't noticed that it's only tinfoil. I always expected the world to someday figure out that I didn't belong here, that I had risen far above my ditch-digging station, so I shouldn't have been surprised when it all started falling apart. Years ago, when I ran away from home to go to college, half-cocked and broke, I had no real expectation that I'd ever earn a living with my head instead of my hands. Working my way through school as a bouncer, I often found myself harboring equal measures of contempt and envy for those guys who lived in that higher strata of life, men who wore pants wrinkled at the hip from sitting all day, their soft hands holding drinks poured with high-end vodka. No steel-toed shoes needed where they worked. If I could just be one of them, I thought I'd be happy. I still remember getting my first paycheck from the Associated Press, how I held it in my hands and stared at it for hours before taking it to the bank. Someone had actually paid me to think, to use my brain. No scraped knuckles, no sore back. A far cry from when I first ventured into the workforce back when I was 16. The summer that I had worked for my mother's landlord remodeling apartments. His name was Terry Bremer, and I learned a lot from him. But boy, that job sucked. Once, on a scorching August day, half blinded by the stinging sweat in my eyes, I crawled into a dusty attic, dragging thick bats of fiberglass insulation to its farthest corners. The itch from that experience stuck with me for a week. Another time, I wore out a pair of leather gloves digging a truly foul-smelling trench to replace a collapsed sewer line. Who'd have thought that I could screw up a desk job so badly that I'd look back at shoveling sewage with a fond nostalgia? Yet I had managed it. When it comes to bad days, it's hard to beat one that starts with a short, bald man serving you with a summons and complaint. I was absorbed by an article that I was writing that day and didn't even hear the man knock. You need a punch code to get into the AP office. I had no idea that he was in the room until I heard him say my name. Another reporter pointed me out, and the man walked up to my desk with a smile on his face. Joe Talbert? He asked. Yeah? He held out an envelope, which I instinctively took. Then he said, "You've been served." I didn't understand at first, because he performed this act with the cheer of someone hoping to receive a tip. "Served?" I asked. His smile grew bigger. "You're being sued for defamation of character. Have a nice day." Then he turned and left the office. I stood there with the envelope in my hand, not sure what to think. Then I looked around the room at the faces of my fellow reporters, hoping to see the smile of a prankster, someone holding back a laugh or biting a lip, but all I saw was a mixture of fear and pity in the eyes of my colleagues, people who were figuring this thing out one step faster than I was. I opened the envelope, pulled out the documents, and recognized the name of the man listed as the plaintiff, State Senator Todd Dobbins. I knew then that this was no prank. This wasn't supposed to happen to me. I had done everything right. I had written the article over a month ago, and it had everything. Sex, scandal, political power, everything that is except a second source. A fact that made my editor, Allison Kress, more than a little nervous at the time. But I had given Allison the bona fides of my one source as well as the corroborating evidence to back up the story. I had convinced Allison that the source was solid. In the end, Allison ran the story as much on the strength of my word as anything else. I walked to Allison's office to show her the document naming me and the Associated Press as co-defendants in a lawsuit, hoping to hear words of comfort, something like, "This happens all the time," or, "Don't worry, it's just a stunt by a corrupt politician." But what she said chilled me to the point that I nearly threw up. Her face went pale as she read the documents, and she told me to close the door and have a seat.
"This is bad, Joe," she said. "Really bad."
"But the story's true," I said. "Truth is a defense to defamation.
The story's only true if we can prove that it's true. That's the problem with stories where you only have one source, an anonymous one at that."
"But I have a source. That's the important thing," I said, hoping that Allison would agree.
"The last I heard, your source doesn't want to be identified. That's a problem. If we can't produce a witness, especially given the circumstances of this story, it's going to look like we made it up. It'll be your word versus his word."
"Their word," I said meekly. Allison looked confused. Mrs. Dobbins wrote out an affidavit backing up her husband's story. Allison had large chocolate eyes that undermined any chance of her holding a poker face. I could tell she was trying to look calm as we spoke, but I could see fear settling in.
"What are the odds that the source would agree to come forward?"
"Come forward?" My source had let go of her rope and now dangled in my grip, trusting that I would not let her fall. Unmasking her identity not only would break a promise that I had made, but would cost her everything. Some lines can't be crossed.
"But reporters use anonymous sources all the time," I said. "Yes, and those reporters run the risk of something like this happening."
Allison shook her head slowly as she continued to read the complaint. I eased back into my chair and waited. When she came to the end, to the part where Dobbins was making his demands, she looked up.
"He wants a retraction, and he wants you fired," she said.
"He also wants a buttload of money. Did you read that?"
"Yeah, but I don't think this is about the money. Your story killed his political career. He's finished at the Capitol. The only way to get that life back is to get some kind of declaration that the story was false. To do that, he needs the retraction. I think having you fired is just icing on his cake."
"They wouldn't fire me, would they?" Allison looked at me with the sad expression that all but said, "Oh, you poor, naive little boy." Then she told me about a reporter who had got fired last year for making a single mistake. He had a perfect record. Not one error in 28 years. But then he misidentified a set of initials on a document, attributing the initials to the wrong politician. That was all it took. I stared out through the windows of Allison's corner office, a view I'd taken in many times before, the last time being a week ago when Allison and I discussed whether my article would be submitted for Pulitzer consideration. Now, we were talking about the end of my career. She balled her hands together and leaned onto her desk, the legal papers at her elbows, her knuckles pressed against her lips.
"There'll be an investigation," she said without looking up. "I'm on the hook with you. I approve the story. If they fire you, they'll fire me too."
And I didn't think I could feel any worse than I already did.
"The AP will give you an attorney. I went through this once when I was a reporter. It sucked. You'll have to waive any conflict of interest or you can hire your own lawyer."
Lila's about to take the bar exam. I'm not sure why I said that. I guess I was thinking out loud.
"You'll need someone who specializes in journalism law. I'm sure Lila's very smart, but don't take this lightly. If you get fired,
No legitimate news outlet will ever hire you again. You'll be blackballed. Just sign the waiver and let the AP lawyers handle it. Yeah, I guess that's the smarter way to go. I waited for Allison to say something to lift my spirits, but that didn't happen. By the time I left her office, my head hurt and my chest squeezed in around my lungs, making it hard to breathe. I spent the rest of the day staring at my computer screen. I didn't trust myself to type a single word. I kept seeing the accusations from the complaint, words and sentences floating across my field of vision. This could be the end of my career. Then what? Go back to digging ditches? Pull up a bar stool and man the door at Molly's pub again? Every time I let those thoughts loose, they nearly choked me. When I couldn't take it anymore, I went home to tell Lila the bad news. The 20-minute trip took me from the crystalline towers of downtown Minneapolis to the working-class neighborhood of St. Paul's Midway, an old part of the city where small houses elbowed each other for space and boxy apartments wore the same dingy yellow brick as the outdated storefronts. The apartment that Lila and I shared, a two-bedroom inside of an 8-unit complex, was the kind of place that most people would drive past and never think back on. It had no balcony, no lawn, no view other than that of the apartment building across the street. And because of a weird guy in that building who liked to stare into our windows, we kept our blinds closed, adding to the prison block feel of our place. It was cheap, however, and close to Lila's law school, and that's what we needed for now. Lila Nash was still just my girlfriend. And when I say just, I mean that I hadn't done the one knee thing yet. I'd thought about it often, but it never seemed to be the right time, with college and then law school. I didn't want to propose to her when she had this final or that memorandum of law to work on. I was pretty sure that she would say yes if I asked, but then she would have to put the ring aside and gone back to her books. I wanted to wait until we could enjoy the moment, give it the gravitas and attention it deserved. I had hoped that the right moment might come after she graduated from law school, but then came the bar exam. We were only 8 days away from that soul-sucking ordeal, and Lila was riding the bull with white knuckles and gritted teeth. She had a job offer with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, an offer that would disappear if she failed the bar. So for the past 2 months, she'd been studying for that test to the exclusion of everything. Everything except for Jeremy, that is. In the middle of all the chaos, Lila somehow found time for my brother. From the start, it was Lila who took the lead in caring for Jeremy. She was the one who trudged through the bureaucratic maze to get Jeremy his first job, sorting items at a recycling center. Lila educated herself on autism, reading a dozen books on the subject after Jeremy came to live with us. She found time for this even as she trimmed back her time with me, because law school was kicking her ass. She and I used to play gin or cribbage almost every night. I can't remember the last time we did that. Her latest project had been reading books with Jeremy. My brother learned to read when he was in school, but our mother never valued that skill, so at home he watched movies. Lila started him on children's books, classics like Snow White and Beauty and the Beast. And though Jeremy didn't like reading books at first, Lila persisted, working with him every day when he came home from his job, going over the words and the pictures, comparing the story on the page to the story on the DVD. After a few months, those books became part of his routine. That's where I found them when I came home that day, sitting on the couch together going over the words of a new book, Dumbo. They both looked up when I came in, Jeremy for only a second before turning his attention back to the page. He had no idea that I was home 3 hours early. Lila, on the other hand, looked at me, then at the clock, and back at me again, lines of confusion tracing across her forehead. "You're early," she said. Neither a question nor an accusation, more of a note that she was jotting down in her thoughts. I walked to the couch, sat next to Lila, and handed her the summons and complaint. Then I leaned back and waited for her to read it. "Oh my God," she whispered. "This is..." She looked at me, her confused expression melding into concern. "You're being sued?" I nodded. "What did you do?" "I didn't do anything," I said, sounding more defensive than I had intended. "I'm sorry, that's not what I meant." She turned on the couch to face me, as if she wanted to look in my eyes as she asked me her next question.
They're saying that you made up a story. You didn't do that, did you?
Of course not. I would never make up a story.
Todd Dobbins. He's that state senator you wrote about. The one who beat up his wife.
Lila turned her attention back to the complaint. Yes, he beat up his wife.
But
Lila read some more, and I could see that she was reading the affidavit, where Mrs. Dobbins was now swearing that her trip to the emergency room happened because she fell down some stairs. She was swearing, under the penalty of perjury, not only that her husband did not hit her, but that he had saved her life by taking her to the hospital. Lila looked up from the document.
If he says that she fell down the stairs, and she says that she fell down the stairs, then
I have a source.
Who?
I can't divulge that, not even to you. I gave my word.
Joe, this is serious.
Don't you think I know that? I heard my voice rise, and I immediately felt bad. Lila wasn't the enemy. I took a deep breath to calm down.
If you don't give up your source, how can you prove your case? Libel law, Times versus Sullivan.
Lila began speaking as though she were reading from a flashcard, her preferred method of study.
There's a different standard if Dobbins is a public figure. And as a state senator, he's got to be a public figure. They'd have to prove that you wrote the article with actual malice, that you knew it was false and wrote it anyway.
My story isn't false.
But your witness is someone you won't disclose. You have nothing to contradict their version of events. You see how this looks, don't you? You've put yourself into a box.
I can't give up my source, I repeated.
I won't.
But even as the words left my lips, I knew that Lila was right. I was screwed. My mind flashed back to my conversation with Allison and the prospect that I would get fired over this. And I was once again on the verge of throwing up. I leaned forward on the couch and cupped my face in my hand.
Slow breath in, slow breath out.
Lila brushed her hand up and down my back, which didn't help, but it was a nice gesture. And then Jeremy spoke. I had forgotten that he was sitting on the couch with us.
Joe, he said, maybe it will be all right.
I sat up and looked at my brother, his hands on his lap, the book lying beside him, the expression on his face one of uncertainty, probably questioning whether his response was appropriate in that situation. I have no doubt that he didn't understand what a lawsuit was, but he understood my reaction to it. He understood that the papers in Lila's hands had hurt me somehow. That was all he needed to know. And the thing he thought to say was the one thing that I wanted to hear. That everything would be okay. I smiled. Of course it'll be okay.
That's right, Lila said, tossing the papers to the floor.
And with that, Lila and I came to an understanding that, at least around Jeremy, nothing bad had happened that day. We dropped the subject and pretended that it was a normal Tuesday. She went back to her studies, and I went to the kitchen where I could sit on the floor out of Jeremy's sight and let the world around me spin out of control. Yet, as bad as that day had been, the day that followed would prove that things can always get worse. Chapter 2. I considered taking that next day off, calling in sick to tend to my wounds. I didn't want to wade past the downturned eyes of my colleagues or hear the low hiss of whispers escaping from the break room as they discussed my failings. But I needed to face this thing. I hadn't done anything wrong, and staying home would have made me appear guilty. Besides, staring at my apartment walls would only let the worms of my self-pity burrow deeper into my brain. Working on another story might help keep my mind off the lawsuit. Who knows? I might even get my appetite back. The AP office was housed in the Grain Exchange Building, a 9-story structure that probably constituted a skyscraper back in 1902 when they built it, the sky being so much lower back then. It stood hunched and heavy on the northern edge of downtown, the thick-fingered uncle of the Minneapolis skyline. Over the past 4 years, I had come to see that office as my second home. Now, as I walked to the elevator, an image popped into my head of my being escorted back out with a box of my personal effects in my arms. Do they really do that when they fire someone? On the fifth floor, I punched the code into the keypad and entered the office of the Associated Press, a smaller space than most people might expect, especially if their concept of a newsroom comes from movies like All the President's Men, where a small army of reporters fills an entire floor. The AP office, which covered news in a four-state area, was just big enough to house six reporters, a break room, a conference room, and a separate office for Allison Kress. We wrote the news while sitting at workstations, a modern form of cubicle with shorter walls so that you had the confinement of a cubicle but not the privacy. The setup had the appearance of a big raft made up of six inner tubes tied together. I was fine with having no walls, though, because I worked on the windowless side of the raft. In slow times, I could look out through the windows, my view bouncing off the top of Gus McFarlane's head, and let my daydreams catch the breeze. Those musings usually transported me to the glass towers of Manhattan or the granite enclaves of Washington, D.C., places where I had once hoped my career might take me. Now, my highest aspiration was to make it to quitting time and still have a job. I had just plopped down into my nest when Gus leaned toward my workstation and whispered, "Hey, Joe, Allison said she wanted to see you when you got in." The bottom fell out of my stomach. "How'd she look?" Gus pondered that for a second before answering, "Serious." I started to get up, but then I changed my mind and sat back down, taking a minute to clean up my browser history. It's not that I had anything scandalous to hide, but I didn't want my replacement to know how frequently I used my thesaurus, and that I still struggled with the proper use of lie, lay, laid, and lain. I looked in my drawers to get an idea of how big of a box I would need for my stuff, and the answer depressed me. The entire accumulation of my personal items would likely fit into a shoebox. Maybe, subconsciously, I'd been preparing for this day all along. A gurgle churned in my stomach as I made my way to Allison's office. She had always been a good boss, smart, level-headed. I was going to miss her, and it killed me to know that I had pulled her into my mess. I paused at the door to gather myself, then knocked. "Come in," Allison said. When she saw me, her neutral expression took on weight. "Hi, Joe. Have a seat." She waved me to a chair. I closed the door and sat down, my hands already sweaty against the tan vinyl of the armrests. "Am I fired?" I asked. "What?" "If you're going to fire me, do it quickly." I kept my eyes open, but I held my breath. "No, Joe, that's not why I wanted to see you." I slowly exhaled. Allison gave me a half smile. "If that were the case," she said, "I'd probably be heading out the door with you." I wanted to say that I was sorry, but I was pretty sure she knew that already. "Joe, do you have any relatives in Caspian County?"
"Caspian County? No. Not that I know of. Why?"
"Not that you know of?"
"My family tree is more of a patch of scrub. I can never be sure what's out there. I have a brother, Jeremy, but you know about him already."
"What about the rest of your family?"
I hesitated, but then answered. "I have a mother in Austin, but I haven't spoken to her in years."
"What about your father?"
"My father? He took off when I was born, left me with nothing but his name."
"You have the same name as your father?"
"Yeah, but I never..." I sat back in my chair, seeing now that Allison was drawing me to a specific target. "What's going on?" I asked. She picked up a piece of paper.
"Do you have any idea where your father might live now?"
"None whatsoever," I said with a hint of pride. I had managed to live my entire life without ever seeing the face of the man whose name I carried. I convinced myself that other than donating his spermatozoa to my cause, my father could just as well have been a myth. A fairy tale that fed my childhood imagination, something I had discarded long ago, tossed aside like an outgrown pair of sneakers. "What's this about?" I asked. She slid a piece of paper across her desk to me, and I read it. It was a press release about a man named Joseph Talbert, who had been found dead in a horse barn by sheriff's deputies in rural Caspian County, Minnesota.
The press release stated that foul play was suspected.
Do you think that might be your father?
She asked. There had to be a lot of Joe Talberts walking around this planet at any given moment, but this one died in Minnesota, and it involved foul play. Those two factors had to increase the odds that this man might be my father.
I don't know, I said. Other than a few stories that my mom told me, I don't know anything about him.
You think your mom might know if he lived in Buckley?
Like I said, I don't talk to my mother.
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to pry. I just thought you should know. I mean, if it were my father, even if I'd never met him, I'd want to know.
I appreciate that, I said. My tone had turned cold. That wasn't my intention.
Are you okay?
Honestly, Allison, I'm not sure.
There's one thing more, Allison said, pulling a second piece of paper out of her drawer. I asked the sheriff's office in Caspian County to send me a picture of the man they found dead. Would you like to see it?
I stared at the paper in her hand, unable to answer. This man meant nothing to me. Less than nothing. I should have walked out of Allison's office and left it that way, but I didn't. I held out my hand, and she handed me an old mugshot. And just like that, the myth that was my father began to grow flesh and bones. Chapter 3. When I was in fourth grade, a kid named Keith Rabinow called me a bastard. I wasn't sure exactly what the word meant, though I'd heard my mother use it often enough, a blunt-tipped arrow shot at the many men who'd screwed her over. Back then, the word bastard fell into a basket of swear words that I could use with some dexterity. That day, in fourth grade, however, I learned that bastard had a special meaning, making it a glove that fit some of us better than others. Rabinow's attack came out of the blue. We weren't in an argument. Not that he and I were ever all that far from a fight at any given moment. Keith was one of the few kids in my class who knew about my mom. What I had pieced together was that our mothers had been friends at one time, back when they were both young and new to the bar scene in Austin. My mom's version of the fall of their friendship was that Libby Rabinow, the tramp, stole a piece of shit named Willard away from her. I used to wonder why my mother cared that Willard had been stolen away from her if he was such a piece of shit. That mystery got cleared up as I came to know my mother better. When Keith called me a bastard, I quickly returned the insult, calling him a bastard, to which he replied, "I'm not a bastard. I have a father." His response threw me because I didn't understand how fathers figured into our little clash. Before I could think of a comeback, Keith read my face and started heaping it on. "You don't even know what a bastard is, do you?" "Yeah, I do," I said. "Just look in the mirror and you'll see a bastard." "A bastard is a kid that doesn't got a dad," he said. "You don't got a dad, so you're a bastard." "I got a dad," I yelled back. "No, you don't," Keith smirked. "My mom says that your mom's a drunk and a bitch, and no man's gonna stay with her no matter what. That makes you a bastard. Joey the Bastard. That should be your name. Joey the Bastard." Some of the other boys on the playground sensed the tension and started forming a small circle around us. A couple of them repeated "Joey the Bastard" in taunting fashion. How Keith didn't see this next part coming is beyond me. Anger clogged my ears, turning Keith's words into a thick, watery hum. I charged in and shoved my hands into his chest, sending him stumbling backward to the ground. He looked up at me with wide eyes, as if my assault had been the last thing he expected. I watched his mask of shock give way to rage, and it was on. Keith scrambled to his feet and came at me with his head down, throwing a shoulder into my chest and clasping his hands around my torso. Landing on my butt with his weight on top of me, I twisted to my right, then to my left, trying to roll him off. He lost his balance enough that I was able to get beside him, my arm now around his neck. With him pinched in a headlock, I fought to steady my hold. By now, a throng of kids had amassed around us, some cheering me on, and some shouting Keith's name, exactly what I'd been hoping for. With our skirmish raising that kind of ruckus, it was only a matter of time before a teacher would break up the fight. It would be a draw. I took my eyes off Keith for a second to look beyond the mob. No teacher yet. And that's when Keith dropped a shoulder and rolled into some kind of jiu-jitsu move that sent me flipping over his back. I closed my eyes as my head hit the ground. When I opened them again, Keith was climbing onto my chest, his arm cocking back. I raised my head, hoping to take the force of his first punch in the top of my skull instead of the face, a move I saw on TV once. It didn't work. He hit me square in my left cheek, and everything went black and sparkly. I was expecting another punch, and frankly, I had no plan on how I might avoid it, but it never came. I felt Keith being pulled off my chest as the chants of the mob died in the breeze. When I opened my eyes, one of the teachers was holding Keith away from me and yelling for me to get up and follow him. When Vice Principal Adkins asked me what caused the fight, I didn't answer. The teacher who broke up the scuffle told Mr. Adkins that they had found Keith on top, so they assumed that he had been the instigator. Keith, however, said that I started it, that I'd gone crazy and attacked him for no good reason. In the end, Adkins leveled the same punishment against us both. We were to go to the library, open a dictionary to a particular page, and write out every word and definition from that page. He could have assigned 100 pages to rewrite that day. It wouldn't have mattered to me. The punishment wasn't the thing that left the mark. As soon as Keith left the office, he ran to find the smallest dictionary in the library, calling dibs on it, and leaving me with the huge Merriam-Webster. Keith had apparently done this punishment before. I opened my dictionary and started to turn to the page chosen by Adkins, but then paused and flipped back until I found the word bastard. Bastard. 1. A person born of unmarried parents. An illegitimate child. 2. Something irregular, inferior, spurious, or unusual. There were explanations on those two definitions, but I didn't read any further. I began writing the punishment, my world now colored by the understanding that I was illegitimate and inferior. I was a bastard. The tongue-lashing I got at school was nothing compared to what awaited me at home. The school had called my mother and told her that I'd been in a fight. That would have been bad enough, but it was the fact that I had been bested by the son of Libby Rabinow that truly got my mother's tea kettle to whistle. When I walked in, she was waiting with a beer in her hand and a scowl on her face.
"What the hell's gotten into you, Joey?"
were the first words out of her mouth. I didn't expect to see her home, because back then she had a job serving cones at the Dairy Queen. One of the few times in my life that I can remember her holding employment for more than a few weeks. When I walked into the apartment, the heat of her anger was already thick in the air, so I didn't respond to her question.
"I had to miss work today. That's $50 out of my paycheck because of you."
I wanted to ask how getting my ass kicked caused her to miss work. They didn't bring her down to the school for a conference. They knew better. My mother was a grenade just looking for someone to pull the pin.
"How do you think it feels to have to call in sick because your son can't stop and think for once in his life? And Keith Rabinow? You had to pick a fight with Keith Rabinow, of all people. You let that little prick get the better of you. I bet he ain't got no shiner on his face."
My head sank under the weight of my shame.
"Of course not," she said. "I can just hear that bitch Libby laughing because her son beat you up. What was this fight about, anyway?"
I looked up to see if her question might be rhetorical, just another ripple in the skipping stone of her tirade. But she stared at me with her hand on her hip, awaiting my response.
"He called me a bastard," I said.
I didn't tell her about how Keith called her a drunk and a bitch. Even at 10, I knew that such a revelation had no upside.
"Well, you are a bastard, goddammit. That no good piece of shit father of yours didn't want nothing to do with you. You got into a fight about him, You may as well just...
She waved her beer hand around in the air, as if the gesture filled in the words that escaped her. Then she took a drink.
Face it. He screwed us both. You have a problem with being a bastard? Take it up with your father. And good luck finding him.
This next part came out of my mouth before I could stop it. I said,
If he was such a no-good piece of shit, why did you go out with him? Why would you name me after him?
Those words hit my mother hard, twisting every muscle in her face and causing red blotches to bloom on her neck. She slammed her beer can down on the table and took a step toward me, her arm shooting out to the side, her finger pointing at the door to my bedroom.
Go to your room,
she screamed. She didn't have to say it twice. I ran to my bedroom, closed the door behind me, and sat with my back pressed against the door, my 10-year-old body ready to block any attempt she might make to come inside. I didn't want to hear another word from her, but more than that, I didn't want to lose my grip on the venomous thoughts that lay coiled in my brain. Some things were better left unspoken. I was a bastard. She was a drunk and a bitch. Those were the monuments we built to each other, the ones that would survive the eventual fall of our relationship. As my anger thinned, I spotted Jeremy rocking forward and back on the bottom bunk of our bed, the tendons in his jaw flexing as he gnashed his teeth together, his right thumb rubbing the knuckle of his left hand, his skin red from the effort. I slid away from the door, scooting across the floor until I was in his line of sight.
Jeremy, don't do that,
I said, putting my hand on his thumb.
You're going to get a sore. It's okay, Jeremy.
Jeremy didn't stop, so I started singing You Got a Friend in Me, a song from Toy Story, his favorite movie at the time. I eased into it, my faulty notes seeping into his consciousness, slowing the velocity of his downward spiral. I was well into the second verse before the pull of the song overcame the turmoil in his head. He joined in, his 3-note range nowhere close to being in tune, but that didn't matter. He knew every word without fail, and singing them, out of tune as he was, brought Jeremy peace. After I got Jeremy calmed down, I climbed to my top bunk and stared at the plaster swirls on the ceiling above my head, my thoughts drifting not to my mother, not to Jeremy, not even to Keith Rabinow, but to my father, a man who wanted nothing to do with me. I had always known it, but before that day, I never understood how his cowardice branded me a bastard. I was illegitimate. I was inferior. He had done this to me. My life came to a divide that day. Before my fight with Keith Rabinow, I would sometimes dream of my father and imagine that he had been torn away from me, held at bay by forces beyond his means. A quiet hero who might someday fight his way back to rescue me from my mother. But after that day, I understood. My father chose to leave. His action made me what I was. He was the reason that I had gotten into the fight with Keith Rabinow. He was the reason my mother yelled at me. My father wasn't a hero. He was a villain. And I cursed him under my breath as the first tears of that day spilled down my cheeks. I vowed to myself that I would never give my father another thought. I would never seek him out. It was over. I would cram the shadow of this man into a box and bury him so deep in my memory that it would never again see the light of day. As I grew older and came to understand the power of internet search engines, I held true to my vow. I never once searched the internet for his name, which meant that I could never do a search for my own name. Like a recovering addict staring at a syringe full of heroin, I would sometimes find myself in front of a computer with my fingers on the keys, itching to type in the words Joe Talbert, just to see where it might take me. But every time that urge arose, I beat it back. I had never once looked for my father. 17 years after I made that vow, I found myself sitting at my station in the Associated Press office, a press release in my hand announcing the death of a man with my name. I took in a deep breath. And for the first time in my life, I typed my name into the internet search box and hit enter. Chapter 4. My first internet search for Joe Talbert Sr. gave me over 400,000 hits. I spent half an hour culling through those links, looking for something relevant before giving up. On my second attempt, I did an image search, looking for people named Joe Talbert, and using the mugshot as a guide. In no time, I found another picture of the man, also a mugshot, but a slightly younger version. I clicked on the image, and it took me to a page where I read about Joe Talbert stealing corn from a grain silo. The picture was a grinning image of a man who looked like he had just shared a joke with the officer taking the picture, the kind of familiarity that comes with being arrested a lot, I suspect. His face had a tougher veneer than mine did, but with a little imagination I could see parts of myself in that old mugshot, especially around the eyes. He had an intensity that I'd seen in my own reflection on occasion. As I stared at this man's face, it dawned on me that I now had mugshots of both my parents to add to the family photo album. After hours of digging, using the internet as well as a handful of databases I could access through the AP, I managed to compile a pretty good list of offenses for Mr. Talbert. In addition to the grain silo fiasco, I found 9 criminal convictions, including criminal damage to property, disorderly conduct, a restraining order violation, assault, 2 threats of violence, and 3 DUIs. I was a little surprised, though, to find that Joe Talbert Sr. had not been arrested in the past 17 years, not since his last DUI arrest in Caspian County. That suggested that he either became a better criminal or had cleaned up his act. As I wrote down the basic information from the Minnesota Court Information System database, I noticed that one of the older cases, an assault, happened in my hometown of Austin at a time when my mother would have been 3 months pregnant with me. That connection made my fingers twitch with energy as I tapped and clicked my way deeper into this man's past. MNCIS had no information about the specific facts of that case beyond the one-line descriptions of various court proceedings. I put a call into the Moore County Court Administrator's office and learned that the physical file would have been purged from the system after 10 years. My call to the county attorney's office yielded the same response. My last hope was that the incident complaint report might still be retained by law enforcement. I crossed my fingers and called the Austin Police Department. "I'm looking for an ICR for a case that occurred 27 years ago," I said. "Would that still be in your system?"
"Oh, heavens, no," she said with the politeness of a pastor's wife. "Our records don't go back that far. I'm not even sure we were on the ICR system that long ago."
My shoulders sagged. There had to be some way to uncover the facts behind that assault. My mother would know, but if that was my only option, forget it.
"If you're looking for something that old," the lady continued, "I'd have to go to the archives and find it on the microfiche."
It took a second for me to catch up. "Wait, you have old police reports on microfiche?"
"Yes, we do."
I wanted to tell her that she should have led with that. Instead, I said, "I'd really appreciate it if I could get reports from an incident that happened on..." I squinted into my computer screen to find the exact date.
"I'll need a request in writing," she interrupted. "I can't give out stuff like that over the phone."
I popped a page of Associated Press letterhead onto my computer screen and typed as we spoke. "What do you need in the letter?"
"Let's see. I'll need the name of the party and the date of the incident, if you have it. If you don't have a date..."
"I have a date," I said, looking at the MNCIS report. "I also have a court file number, if that helps."
"No, just the name and date of the incident. I can't give you anything if the case is still pending, but a case that old..."
"He was convicted, so it's closed." She gave me an email address and told me that if there weren't too many pages to the report, she might be able to send it to me within a few minutes. I thanked her and hung up the phone. I grabbed a couple granola bars from a box I kept in my drawer, ate them in place of lunch, and was about to go back to my search when I noticed that I had an email waiting in my inbox. Too soon to be Moore County, I thought. I looked and saw that it came from the legal department of the Associated Press. I froze, and again my stomach went queasy on me. I didn't open it right away. Would the AP fire me through an email? I had no idea. I'd never been fired before. I looked at Allison's office. Her door stood open, and I could see her at her desk. She didn't seem upset, like she'd been fired. And if they hadn't fired her yet, this email might not be bad news. Finally, I clicked on the email and read it.
Hello, Mr. Talbert. My name is Joette Breck. I have been assigned to look into the lawsuit recently served upon you and the Associated Press. I have reviewed the article you wrote and the complaint of Mr. Todd Dobbins, and have come to the conclusion that your interests and the interests of the Associated Press are joined. As a preliminary matter, I do not see a conflict of interest. As such, we would offer our services to you should you want them. I have attached a waiver of conflict of interest form to this email. Please read the 3-page explanation carefully. If you understand and agree, sign the form and send it back. After I receive that form, I'll be in touch. Respectfully, J. Breck.
I read the attachment she referenced, and most of it was blah, blah, blah. But there was this one line that stuck out. They informed me that representing me in the lawsuit did not preclude them from firing me. In fact, they could use any information gathered in their representation of me, other than privileged communication, to justify my dismissal. I had second thoughts about signing the waiver after reading that line, but I brushed those doubts away. I was getting a free attorney, and I wouldn't be looking that gift horse in the mouth. After signing, scanning, and sending the waiver back to Ms. Breck, I returned to my project, typing Joe Talbert into a search engine and adding Buckley, Minnesota to the query. That search eventually led me to a news article. A photo attached to the article showed Joe Talbert with touches of gray now invading his crown, and lines under his eyes that put his appearance closer to 50. He stood at a podium with his mouth open, his face crinkled in anger, and his index finger pointing up, as if he were about to fling it at someone. The story had appeared 2 years ago in the Caspian County Courier, and it chronicled a city council meeting where Joe Toke Talbert fought against the city's decision to have his property declared a public nuisance due to the number of inoperable cars parked on his lawn. Toke? I said out loud. His nickname was Toke, and he collected junked cars. Somehow that seemed fitting. I read the rest of the article, but it gave no further details. Then I checked my email and saw that the Austin Police Department had responded to my document request. I clicked it open and read about a fight in a McDonald's parking lot. A man identified as Joe Talbert, this must have been before he came up with the slick nickname, had been seen yelling at a woman and shoving his finger into her face. A McDonald's employee reported the disturbance, watching from inside the restaurant as the argument escalated. The employee could not hear the argument itself, but stated that he saw the man push the woman and then punch her in the stomach, causing her to drop to her knees. The report identified the woman as Kathy Nelson, my mother. He hit my mother when I was in her womb. The investigating officer questioned my mother, who confirmed that her boyfriend had gotten mad and punched her. When asked what caused Talbert to become upset, my mother told the officer that she was pregnant and refused to get an abortion. He wanted to abort me. That son of a bitch. My cheeks grew hot, and for a moment, the lawsuit and everything else shitty in my life melted away, leaving this piece of human waste alone in my spotlight. I didn't know that I could detest Joe Talbert Sr. more than I already did, but now the notion that this man was found dead in a barn filled me with an odd sense of contentment. I don't think Hallmark makes cards for families like mine. I went back to my search, clicking on the next hit for Toke Talbert, and found an obituary for Jeannie Talbert, a 42-year-old woman who had died 6 months ago on her farm in rural Caspian County. The obituary read that Jeannie had been born Jeannie Hicks and graduated from Buckley High School. She attended college at Mankato State University, where she received a degree in paralegal studies. After that, she returned to Buckley and went to work for a local attorney. At the bottom of the article, I read that Jeannie was survived by her husband, Joseph Toke Talbert, and a daughter, Angel Talbert. I stopped reading, my mind slowly wrapping around those last words. Survived by a daughter, Angel Talbert. I had a sister. Chapter 5. By the time I got home, Jeremy had already finished his reading assignment and was sitting in front of the TV watching his new favorite movie, Guardians of the Galaxy, which Lila let him watch as a reward for making it through the day. There was a time when his reward was tied to Jeremy finishing his reading assignment, but he had grown to like reading his books. Now the greatest challenge for Jeremy was his new job. Having moved from sorting bottles at the recycling center to cleaning classrooms at a nearby high school. This advancement came with a tangle of new stressors, and we were still in the process of getting Jeremy acclimated to his new routine. For someone like Jeremy, consistency could be as important as food. He preferred dark clothing over light colors, green above all else. He ate his meals in order of meats first, then potatoes, then vegetables. If we served soup or chili, the biggest chunks went first. Cereal, cinnamon life, nothing else. What would be a banal routine for most people was for Jeremy a dance, choreography that could move him from the beginning of the day to the end as smoothly as possible. With the disruption brought on by the new job, we had been giving Jeremy a little extra time with his movies. When I came through the door, I said my usual, "Hey, buddy, how's it going?" He looked at me, a hesitant smile cracking across his face, and said, "I am Groot." I forced myself to laugh, and he briefly joined in before going back to his movie. He'd been greeting me that way a lot lately, mimicking the tree character from Guardians of the Galaxy, who communicated a wide range of topics using only those three words. At first, I thought it was funny, even encouraging that Jeremy understood the concept. But lately it had begun to wear on me. I went to talk to Lila, finding her in her usual spot, sitting in the middle of our bed, books spread out around her, a tablet of notes resting against her knee and headphones on her head to keep the sound of Jeremy's movie out of her ears. When she saw me, she smiled, slipped the headphones off, and rubbed exhaustion from her eyes. "How goes the battle?" I asked.
"I hate property," she said. "If they ask an essay question on property, I'm screwed."
I hovered over her, trying to figure out the best way to launch into the crazy left turn that my life had taken. I wanted to draw my presentation out, maybe make it a guessing game that she could never win. But when I saw how tired she looked, and knowing how the stress of studying could sometimes shorten her patience, I decided to abandon my game and simply hand her Toke Talbert's mugshot.
"Who's this?" she asked. Only half interested.
"That's Joe Talbert Sr." She sat up straighter.
"As in, your dad?"
She looked at the picture, then at me, doing the same comparison that I had done a few hours earlier.
"I don't understand. All these years, I mean, why would you?"
"He died last night." Lila went quiet. "I don't know much about it, but the press release said they suspect foul play."
"They think your dad was murdered?"
I took a seat on the bed beside her. The press release didn't give any details, other than that he's been living in Buckley, Minnesota.
"Where's Buckley?"
"About an hour north of the Iowa border, out in the middle of nowhere." She leaned toward me and put her hand on my forearm.
"I'm sorry, I think. I'm not sure what to say here."
"There's more," I said. "I have a sister. Well, half-sister. Her name is Angel. I found an obituary from when her mom died. The mom's name was Jeannie Talbert, and she died 6 months ago."
"So if her mom died 6 months ago, and her dad died last night..."
"That would mean that my sister's an orphan," I said.
"How old is she?"
"I don't know." Lila picked up her laptop and typed Angel's name into a search. It took a little sifting to find the correct Angel Talbert, but we found her on a social media site, her profile light on both content and followers. She had a picture posted, a mousy image of a girl with hair the color of old hay that hung down in tangled strands, hiding much of her face. Her profile gave her age as 14. I reached down and enlarged the picture, searching for a resemblance behind the fallen hair, and finding none. Instead, I found a set of deeply shadowed, furtive eyes. My sister, the orphan. Her brother, the bastard. The most recent activity on her page was a post made that morning. It came from a girl named Amber, and it read, Get well, Angel. We're praying for you. Below that were some replies. Lila clicked on them. Brandon. Get well? Praying? What happened? Amber. They found her unconscious at her house last night. Jace. I heard she died. Amber. Her dad died. She's still alive, I think. Brandon. Does anyone know what happened? Tyler. Oh my gosh. First her mom, then her dad. Does she have anyone left? Amber. Any relatives? I don't think so.
Rob. My mom's an EMT. I heard her telling Dad that Angel tried to kill herself.
Jordan. That sounds like Angel. She can't do anything right. She even effed up her own suicide. What a loser.
Tyler. Stop being a troll, Jordan. Have some respect.
Jordan. You all need to stop being so fake. Stop pretending that you were friends. If she didn't try to kill herself, none of you would give a crap about Angel Talbert. That's the truth, and you know it. I'm just being honest.
Tyler.
This is Angel's timeline, you dickweed. You want to be a jerk? Don't do it here.
That was the last entry.
Poor girl,
Lila whispered.
How could they be so mean to her?
No one down there knows that I exist, I said. No one knows that Angel might have a brother.
To blast her like that and call her a loser for a failed suicide attempt. How could anyone?
I need to go to Buckley, I said.
Go to Buckley?
My statement seemed to catch Lila off guard.
What are you talking about? You can't go to Buckley right now.
Angel might be my sister. She's an orphan. I could be her only relative and no one knows it.
Yeah, but...
Lila looked at me as though her point was so obvious that she shouldn't have to finish the sentence, but then she did.
The bar exam is next week. I'm not ready. If I don't pass the bar, I'm out of a job.
What if this Toke Talbert guy is, or was, my father? I can't just stay here and ignore that.
If you really want to know about your father, maybe you should start by talking to your mother.
I stiffened and pulled back like a dog getting jolted by a shock collar. The look on my face was enough to drop Lila's gaze.
My mother is dead, I said.
She's not dead. And quit saying that. What if Jeremy hears you?
Lila nodded toward the open door. I walked over and closed it.
She may as well be dead, you know that.
No, I don't.
Lila said in a soft voice, her thoughts seeming to turn inward. I stared at Lila, not really sure of what I was hearing.
It's been 5 years, Joe,
Lila said quietly.
People change. Where was this coming from? Had she forgotten the hell that my mother put us through? People change? What did she mean by that?
I hardened my gaze but kept my voice level and said,
no.
All I'm saying is,
no,
I said again, although not as level this time. Lila stared at me like a cat about to hiss.
I'm sorry, Lila,
I said, hoping to smooth down the rough edge of our conversation.
You know why I can't open that door again. What she did to Jeremy? What she said about me at that guardianship hearing? We can't go back there, ever.
Lila didn't respond. I wanted to move to a different topic, get us away from my mother, so I brought up my trip to Buckley again. If Angel's in a hospital, do you think they'd let me visit her?
What?
Angel, my sister, will the hospital let me in to see her?
You're going to visit her? You don't even know for sure that she is your sister. Don't you think you should wait?
I didn't really have a plan to visit Angel. I just wanted to ease back into the conversation about my trip with something neutral. Maybe knock a few stones off the wall building up between us.
I suppose you're right, I said. You're still planning on going to Buckley?
I won't be gone long. An overnight, at best.
Who's going to take care of Jeremy while you're gone?
Jeremy's fine.
Jeremy's not fine.
Lila found her footing again.
He hates his new job. It takes me half an hour of working with him before he stops rubbing his knuckles when he comes home. And you're not here in the mornings when I'm getting him ready for work. It breaks my heart to put him on that bus. He hates his job.
He'll get used to it. He did the same thing when he started at the recycling center.
But that's the point. He's not used to it. This is the week before the bar. I don't need this, Joe. Not right now.
Angel's all alone. She's just a kid. I was hitting below the belt by aiming at Lila's soft spot for the helpless and weak. Behind her narrowed eyes, I could see her thoughts whirling. My mother, the bar exam, Jeremy. Colors that refused to blend together. I could tell that she had a lot more to say on each of those subjects, but she held her tongue. Instead, she closed her eyes and softly shook her head. Then, she slipped her headphones back on. Our conversation wasn't over, but she had put her headphones on, so it was over for now. It would resume after supper, and again, as I packed my bag for the trip to Buckley, neither conversation advancing the